unlike most of the other papers in this panel, I'm not looking at some of these transnational peoples as immigrants or people in minority context. I'm rather looking at more class-based constraints on access to jobs or the gatekeeping effects that are more based on class in society. And also, I'm not looking into the ethnographic details of individual speakers' experiences, but I'm more relying on broader historical trends in the Korean job market. So it's a little bit different from other papers in this panel, but I think there are important common themes that I hope will be so that's where I'm going. So what I want to talk about centers around the what I call the promise of English, as it says in my title. So what I mean by the promise of English is basically the belief that if you learn English, that will bring you some kind of a benefit to you. So there are many different aspects to this, but I think one of the most salient and powerful one is its economic version, which is basically if you learn English, then that will give you better jobs and better pay. And of course, these kind of beliefs often serve as justification for the spread of English in many different contexts. But of course, this kind of view can be problematic. And basically, the line that I'm going is because English or any other language does not exist in some kind of a mutual economic space, but within the linguistic market, to use a Buddhist term, and which is organized by relationships of power and inequality. And therefore, the benefits we can gain from speaking English will always be constrained by those certain relationships of power. And of course, I'm not the first person to point this out, and many teachers have talked about the fallacy of this promise of English. So for example, one article by Penny Cook says, particularly salient today are claims that English holds out promise of social and economic development to all those who learn it, and that English is a language of equal opportunity. This thing called English colludes with many of the pernicious process of globalization and deludes many learners to false promises it holds out for social and material gain. And the quote I particularly like is the one by James Tollefson in his 1991 book. It says, we must reject the notion that learning a language is an ideologically neutral act intended simply to develop an employment skill. That some people must learn English to get a job is a result of unequal relationships of power, not a solution to that. So what I want to do is I want to build on the insights of these scholars and then try to connect this idea of the promise of English with more specific context of the Korean job market. And I think what's at the heart of the matter here is the fact that what counts as good competence in any language is a matter of a social construction, which is constrained by the structure of the linguistic market. So we tend to think of linguistic competence as something that is objectively measurable and also intuitively identifiable. But if you think about it, whenever we evaluate somebody's speech, we always do so in the context of our own social position and the social relationship we are with the speaker. So that necessarily constrains how the way we evaluate the speaker's competence. So in this talk, what I'm going to talk about is how the promise of English is basically an illusion, particularly in the way it is articulated in popular discourse about the practical utility of English. I'm not necessarily saying that there's nothing to be gained from learning English. Of course, obviously, there is things to gain from English, and for example, I benefit a lot from the fact that I am able to speak English, so I'm not going to deny that, of course. But my point is that what can be gained from English is always subject to the structure and constraints of the linguistic market. Therefore, it's not something that exists freely out there that anyone can grab just by learning English. And that the linguistic market constantly redefines what counts as valid competence, and therefore reproducing and justifying its own structure. And I want to talk about this in context of the Korean job market. So I'd like to do a brief overview of the South Korean English in South Korea. So first, South Korea is one country where there is a very heavy emphasis on learning English, even though the country itself is very strongly monolingual in many aspects, at least in relative terms. And many workers, particularly white-collar workers, invested a lot of time and money in learning English, and also this has the effect on the education domain as well. So lots of students also invest a lot of time and money to study English. And there's a huge market for private language institutes, or there are different kinds of, there's a recent boom in short-term study abroad to English-speaking countries, people hope to gain more confidence in English in this way. So these are the boom in English language learning. And part of this boom is driven by, this boom is driven partly by this promise of English, basically. People believing that this will give them some economic gain in some way. And there's actually some basis to this, because in the white-collar job market, many corporations use English language skills as a criterion for hiring people in both employment and in job promotion. So these kind of things, it seems like if you do study English, then there are things you can get in the job market. But then things are, of course, more complicated because the playing field of the job market is, of course, unequal. So people with better economic capital and cultural capital will always be able to get ahead of others because they're also able to access better opportunities for learning English. So this is the general situation of the situation of English in South Korea. And one of the critical junctures in understanding how the promise of English functions within the Korean job market, I think, is to observe how English has been used in historical context within the hiring practices of major corporations in South Korea. So I'm going to talk about that briefly. So if you go back to 1995, at this time, many of the major Korean corporations were undergoing some massive kind of restructuring. And this was part of the whole South Korea's globalization drive that the government initiated in 1995. So lots of the corporations are trying to reinvent their image, trying to present themselves as corporations that are well prepared for competing in the global marketplace and companies that were able to bring Korea's status as a global major global player. And therefore, many aspects of Korean corporate culture went under revision. And one of the relevant things for us today is the change in the way people, corporations hire people. Okay? So this phenomenon is actually called as 채용 파괴 at the time, which basically means shattering of the hiring practices. It sounds a little odd in English, but that's what it means. What happened was that very conventional types of means of skills assessment for hiring new workers were being replaced with new means which were supposed to be more oriented towards identifying skills that are appropriate for the global economy. So in terms of English, what was happening previously was that for all applicants to a company would take a written English test, which are based on more traditional tests of English that are used in Korean schools. So basically, these are tests that focus on more grammatical knowledge, which is the more dominant mode of English language teaching in Korean schools in early 1990s and before that. But around 1995, this form of testing came to be seen as kind of outdated, and to be more appropriate for the global age, we're going to replace it with things like TOEIC or TOEFL. So TOEIC is a test of English as for international communication, and TOEFL is a test of English as a foreign language, which are both produced and administered by the Education and Testing Service. I think it's U.S. based. So many companies started to adopt TOEIC and TOEFL as a means of assessing candidates' language skills, because they saw it as more globally oriented and also more, at least comparatively, from more oriented towards a spoken communication compared to more traditional exams. But for after this, then TOEIC and TOEFL became very popular, and because people wanted to work with these companies, everybody was studying TOEIC and TOEFL. But by 2005, TOEIC and TOEFL started to lose its popularity as a means of assessment. So many companies start to discard TOEIC and TOEFL as a means of assessment, or if they retained it as a criteria, they started to reduce the importance of these tests, and instead started to introduce alternative methods such as interviews in English or group discussions in English. So the top candidates would have a group discussion in English among themselves and people would observe and, oh, that's Mrs. Rao, something like that. And basically the reason for this was that during the past 10 years, people were studying for TOEIC so hard that everybody's TOEIC score were like becoming like perfect. So I'm here as an illustration of this. I'm citing one newspaper article that reports on the corporation's perspective on this phenomenon. So in this newspaper article, it says, unlike 5-6 years ago, when there were only a few candidates with scores of 900 and above, nowadays there are so many high scores that TOEIC scores are becoming meaningless. And so this is a trend that, because it was so important, everybody we're all studying for it, and then kind of meaningless. But what I think is interesting here is that how the corporations responded to this change. Because one way of interpreting this phenomenon is to say that, okay, because now everybody is having all these high TOEIC scores, that means that many people's general confidence in English has increased, and therefore we're not going to worry too much about English from now on. And so now we're going to look at other criteria when we hire people, instead of looking at candidates' English. But instead of doing that, what the corporation claimed was that despite the abundance of high scores, confident speakers of English are still rare. And therefore, these tests cannot be trusted. And that's the reason why we're switching to alternative means of assessing English skills. So we're not going to abandon testing the English skills of the workers. So we had to put a couple of newspapers reports. Getting a perfect score on TOEIC does not mean one can speak English well. We cannot trust that a candidate with a high score on TOEIC will have the ability to use English effectively. Another report says, one can raise one's score in a short period of time just by learning how to make the right guess, regardless of one's English kind of skills. So as language specialists, of course, it seems obvious to us that a test like TOEIC cannot be a full representation of a person's communicative competence. So that seems obvious to us. But I think what really strikes me is that the discourse of the corporations that they produced in response to this, right? Because when they switched to TOEIC, they were kind of basically saying the same thing, right? So previous tests are really not a reflection of their real competence, so we're going to switch to something better, right? But now they're kind of repeating that discourse, right? And also, I think it's the way in which they kind of vehemently deny the possibility that Koreans' competence in English could have actually improved. I think that's also remarkable. I mean, of course, this is just test scores, but even if students were mostly focusing on test preparation, they certainly must have gotten something out of it, right? I mean, I think this is in fact a remarkable achievement that, you know, the general score of candidates all went up so that to the extent that it became useless. I think that there is some kind of achievement in there, though it might be limited in many ways. And in the way that this was completely denied, I think is a very significant aspect of the discourse used by the corporations. So I think the way I want to look at this is to view it as ideological recalibration of what counts as good English skills. So previously, in a very early period, then if you can pass a written English test, that's grammatical knowledge, you have good skills in English. But after that, you have to have a high score in TOEIC. But now you have to be able to communicate with a foreigner in a more very competent way. And so there's a constant recalibration of what counts as good English skills. And this is, of course, natural because as more job seekers gain better scores on tests, then the need to recalibrate this is introduced. But the main corporate purpose of this, obviously, to be able to keep using English as some means of distinction rather than abandoning it as an important sign. So what I think is going on here is that this would have an effect of maintaining the myth that anyone could still access value jobs through proper investment in English. So in other words, because the claim of the corporation is basically that these workers still cannot speak English well, when I apply for a company and I don't get a job or only get a kind of lower paying job than I expected to, then that's not the fault of the evaluation system, but it's because of me, because I'm the one who is lacking in good English skills. So in the sense that the reason many workers can't get the their value jobs is simply because their English competence is not good. And if they only study a little bit hard enough, maybe they'll be able to get it. So keep working. So I think I want to compare this situation with another situation, which is quite different, but I think it has kind of common mechanism behind it. And this is how gender discrimination was introduced into the workplace when women first entered the job market in Western context in the mid 20th century. So I based this on the paper that I did place. And what she says is that when women entered the job market, they didn't create new jobs, but took over some men's jobs and transformed it into women's jobs. So in other words, the job market had to be kind of reorganized into men's jobs and women's jobs in some way. And how that happened was that it was this kind of hierarchic organization was done based on some kind of system of valuation and skills. So what happened was basically that the jobs that were seen as more skillful went to the men, and the ones that were seen as unskilled jobs tend to go to the women. And certain jobs that are seen as more appropriate for the stereotypical image or qualities of women also went to the managers or clerks or secretaries and those kind of things. So basically what's going on here is, again, some kind of introduction of a system of re-evaluation of what counts as valuable skills. Right? So the price says, gender discrimination on the labor market operates by social recognition or denial of competences and skills. Recognition of skills is mediated by power relations. Notice the power relationship between men and women that exist in the domestic sphere was extended to the job market. And then whatever competence and skills that women had were denied, so that it was made to be seen that women can only work in kind of less skilled kind of jobs. So this is quite a different situation, but I think in the Korean case and the case of the women in the job market, I think there are some similarity and the common mechanism behind this, which is that there is some form of assessment which is meant to be seen as neutral and objective. So in the case of the Korean job market, the lack of competence in English of the job candidates are constructed as kind of seen as some natural quality that is not imposed by some kind of class structure, but something that is inherent in the speaker, right? And therefore that is used to justify the exclusionary effect of the job market. So in this sense, I think the changes in the Korean job market are not about necessarily about English per se, but more about the nature of the neoliberal job market, in which workers are continuously expected to compete with each other and engage in self-management, and so that they're constantly improving themselves. But despite that, they cannot really hope to achieve their goals simply by aiming for the goals that the corporations are suggesting to them. So I think it's part of a more general mechanism. But I think the fact that English is involved here is important, because English does play an important role in obscuring this order, because linguistic competence is often considered to be a matter of objective evaluation, as I said before, rather than as a social construction. So I think that this connects to the idea that Ingrid talked about earlier in her talk, that English often serves as a pretext for other kinds of discrimination. Right? So in this case, English kind of obscuring this more general mechanism. The conclusions. In the Korean job market, then, I would say that the fulfillment of the promise in English is constantly deferred, right? In the sense that it's kind of like an illusion and a mirage. You're constantly trying to get it, and you get closer, but then the bar is raised, and then you need to go further, and so forth. So, in a sense, people can benefit from English, but it does not exist in a way that you can just freely grab it and just benefit from it. Instead, the promise of English, I believe, serves to rationalize and justifies the neoliberal order of the job market and social inequality. So I think there's a need to think about the kind of role that English plays in constructing this.